Welcome to the People's Historian Podcast with the Zen Education Project, coordinated by Teaching for Change and Rethinking Schools. I'm Jesse Hagopian, a co-editor of Rethinking Schools and host of this series on Teach the Black Freedom Struggle. Today, Africana Studies professor Julius B. Fleming Jr. and educator Jessica Rucker discuss the role of Black theater in the Black freedom struggle and the concept of Black patience. So let's jump in.
So for those who don't know, I'm a student right now, and I had the great opportunity in the fall of 2023, just this last fall, to enroll in Dr. Fleming or Julius's course. And we had the opportunity to read Black Patience, Performance, Civil Rights, and the Unfinished Project of Emancipation. So let's just start off, Julius, what is Black Patience?
So before actually I jump in, I just want to say thanks to the Zen Ed Project for having me. Also, thanks to you, Jessica, for being in the conversation. You really clarify for me how any good teacher has to also learn from the student. And you taught me a lot, so thank you for that. Black patience, where would I start? So I was doing research for this book. At the time, it was a dissertation. And I kept encountering, I knew that I wanted to study the 1950s. I knew that I wanted to study the civil rights movement. At the time, I was reading novels and poetry and all sorts of things. And I came across plays. And I noticed that what connected all of these things was this insistent demand for freedom now. So I just started to wonder, well, why are all these Black people demanding freedom now? Why aren't they saying, let's work toward freedom? Why aren't they saying freedom will eventually arrive? They want it now. And so they had to have been responding to something. And so as I started to study, I realized that there was this call, particularly from white people, for Black people to go slow, and not only to go slow, but to be patient.
And right now I'm hearing in my head Nina Simone. How does this all go, Julius?
Go slow, right?
that's the hook. We like, nah. Yeah, and I feel that. And so the book for me really looked at race, but also time and violence. And that's how I came to understand Black patience, this way in which the white supremacist state wanted Black people to slow up, you know, for this thing called freedom. Be patient. So this thing that could be considered very virtuous was then weaponized against Black people. And so I want to stay here with Black patience, but I'm thinking a little bit right now of Sadia Hartman. And she has this idea that slavery has afterlives. Right. And so based on your description of Black patience, I think Black patience is actually one of slavery's many afterlives.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, what did Black patience look like or sound like or feel like during the era of the emancipation through the 1960s? Or in other words, please share some examples of what Black patience might look like in action. Like, what does it mean for Black people to be told to go slow? Like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I love that connection that you're making between slavery and slavery's afterlife, right? What Hartman calls slavery's afterlife, which is just a way of saying, you know, even though slavery has been legally abolished, what are the effects of slavery? How does slavery reverberate into the present moment? So during slavery, I was interested in all of these moments where Black people, where Black bodies had to wait, right? So if we go back to the West Coast of Africa, for example, they were forced to wait in slave castles before they were then put on the ships, the slave ships, that would then carry them across the Atlantic to the New World. They were forced to wait in the belly of those ships for months as they made that transatlantic voyage, the Middle Passage. And then they were forced to wait on the auction block, for example, as they were being sold. Once they got to the plantation, they had to wait for permission from their master to even leave the plantation. So there was, in other words, in slavery, there was already this long history of waiting that Black people had been subjected to. So now that we are in the context of emancipation and Black people are starting to argue for freedom, already in the 19th century, there's this really robust, thick conversation about why Black people need to wait, why we can't go too fast, why we can't move too quickly toward making Black people human or citizens when they've been a slave, right? And the argument was that society just isn't ready for it. white society just isn't ready for it. And in the 19th century, they also can lean into this kind of Christian discourse of just wait on the Lord, which obviously a lot of enslaved folk were into for a number of reasons. But by the time we get to the middle of the 20th century, and there's an important year in the 1960s, and that's 1963. That's the Emancipation Proclamation centennial, or 100 years since Abraham Lincoln signed that document. And Black people across the United States, obviously, but Black people around the world are saying, we have been waiting for a long time, and that freedom hasn't come yet. And so this is what they're picking up on, and this is what ultimately leads to them demanding freedom now.
Yeah, I love it, and I'm with it. Tell me a little bit more. I like what you mentioned, the language of waiting. What's the difference in based on like your reading of these novels, these poems, these plays? How are you thinking about the difference between patience and waiting? And why is it important for educators to make this distinction when they're teaching about the Black freedom struggle?
Yeah, so initially, that's a good question. The book was called The Waiting Room. And I talked to some advisors, they're like, people are gonna think that's a book about a hospital, but I was really into waiting at the
Well,
time.
listen, this democracy does need to be triaged.
It does need to be triaged. And Black people are forced to be patient in waiting rooms across the country, right? Leading to all kinds of, mortalities. It's real. But, as I was doing the research, patience kept coming up, not only from Black people who were saying we don't want to be patient, but white people themselves were asking Black people to be patient. So, for example, President Dwight Eisenhower, in speeches throughout that era, he specifically asked, quote unquote, the Negroes to be patient and to wait because society wasn't ready. So, in other words, patience was a part of the language the white supremacists were using to demand that Black people wait. The other part of it is that when we think about the difference between waiting and patience, I'm thinking about, my mother, when she would, I would want something and she would say, wait on it. I could wait with an attitude, right? And if you know my mother, that would, as I saw somebody's on here from Mississippi, Meridian, Mississippi. I had a Mississippi mother. So even if I didn't want to wait a certain way, I had to look like I was happy to wait. That's when we move into the terrain of patience. Because patience means to wait willingly, to sacrifice willingly, to willingly engage in long suffering without the attitude. So a part of what the book is saying is that white supremacy not only wants Black people to wait, but they want them to wait a certain way. They want it to be a virtuous kind of waiting, a willingness to wait that then rises to the level of patience.
Yeah, right on, right on. But Black people are not waiting. We not gonna wait for Godot. And we'll come back. We'll come back to Beckett's piece in just a minute. You insist that or you in the book make clear that Black people are making insistent demands for freedom now, just throughout the civil rights movement, but also the long Black freedom struggle. Why is that slogan so important? Or what does like the notion, not just the notion, but the practice of freedom now tell us about the relationship between time, Black life, and the civil rights movement? Or also tell us like what's happening in the United States in terms of modernity and speed and acceleration, and why does this seem like a paradox? Yeah.
Yeah, so and can you all hear, can people hear me? Okay. All right. So we have to think about this 1950s, 1960s moment, and to go back to Eisenhower, this is a moment when he gives $100 million, authorizes $100 million for Congress to establish NASA because he wants to beat the Russians into outer space. At the same time, we have trains that are going faster, we have airplanes that are going faster, we have new systems of finance that can move money across the world faster. We have television that can make information travel at record speeds, right? So, in other words, the whole pace of the modern world is speeding up. Eisenhower supports this. At the same time, he's asking Black people in several speeches to be patient and to wait. And he says that we cannot go too fast in what he called this delicate field that involves the emotions of so many. Right, so a part of what happens then is that Black people are asked not to be in line with the pace of the modern world. As things are going speeding up, they're being asked to go slower, and they recognize it. And this is a part of why they say we will not wait because we see the trick that is at work here.
Yeah, so in the 1950s, if I understand what you're saying, like when my grandmother would have been finishing up her secondary learning experiences, it would have been quicker. It was quicker for the United States to put a person in a spaceship to go to the moon than it would have been for her to be in a setting where things she had equal access to learning materials and books, right? Is that what you're saying? So we can go fast in all these other areas, but when it comes to Black people having access to their freedom rights, that we gotta take time. And I wonder if any teacher comrades on the line can kind of relate to that. You're asking whether it's your local or internal administrator or the administration or the broader kind of school system for some changes that you know is gonna support your students, but they like, hold up, just we're on it. We're working towards that. And I love how in the book you talk about how Black people are pushing back against that. Oh, go for it. What are you about to say?
Oh no, I'm listening.
No, you're good. Okay. I kind of now want to look at the role of Black cultural workers, because I think your book, Black Patience, does an excellent job teaching readers about the role of Black theater workers in particular and how they help to speed up time and kind of spread this collective demand for freedom now, or in the words of Dr. King, how Black theater workers help move, help time. And I don't think I'd ever thought about Black theater workers as freedom fighters in quite the way that your book helped me do that. So for example, let's start there. How did Black theater folks in the Black theater movement at the time, or Black theater workers, help speed up and spread this collective demand of freedom now?
Yeah, so in the really in the same ways that all other civil rights activists were doing this work, Black cultural workers, Black artists were also doing this work with their art. So, for example, in the book I write about the Free Southern Theater, this is a Black theater that was established in Mississippi, which in many ways is the belly of anti-Black oppression and white supremacy in the Jim Crow South. And yet they start this theater because they said if theater can have any political meaning anywhere, it's in Mississippi. And a part of what inspired them to start that movement was that they had seen a production of Samuel Beckett's play Waiting for Godot at Alcatraz Prison. And they said, if this play can have meaning at Alcatraz, it can have meaning at that larger prison, Mississippi. And so they start this theater. And what's so crucial about that for me when I was writing this book, we talk a lot about we teach the civil rights movement through the sit-in, through the jailing, the marches, the speeches from Dr. King, is that what if you actually go to the archive, if you actually go to the records that were left from the past, these theater workers were right there. They were right there with those, they stayed with SNCC activists. They had bombs thrown at the stage while they were performing. They were subjected to police brutality. In one instance, they were performing in Mississippi, for example, in Beulah, Mississippi, and they were taken to a police station. And the police officers asked them questions like, how is that white pussy boy? How does it feel to screw a white woman? All of these questions, right? And then they released them and they caught the Ku Klux Klan and told them to pick them up. And so they had to crawl along Mississippi roads, hide in weeds to dodge the Ku Klux Klan. And luckily they survived. So, alongside something like that, Jessica, when they applied to work for with the Free Southern Theater, they were asked questions on the application like, can your family afford to pay $500 bail in the event that you are arrested? This is 1960s Mississippi. Among a lot of working class Black folk, $500 is a lot of money. So, in other words, this just points to the danger, the immense danger that these artists were in, how they sacrificed life and limb to participate in the movement in the same ways that other activists were.
Yeah, this is really, really powerful. And you talked a little bit about like why Mississippi became the ideal stage, so to speak, no pun intended, for the Free Southern Theater. Tell us a little bit about like how it came to be, because in the book you also do a great job at teaching me about the Mississippi Free Press and the role of Tougaloo College. So how is the Mississippi Free Press and Tougaloo College connected to the Free Southern Theater, and like why also is Mississippi so important? Like what does Mississippi, how does where this is taking place change our minds about the civil rights movement? in terms of who we see as the architects or moving the movement forward.
I'm sorry, I just saw Judy Richardson's name in the chat, so I'm having a little bit of a fanboy moment. So you guys forgive me. Yeah, so I mean, I'm from Mississippi, so obviously I'm biased, and obviously we know how Mississippi circulates in people's minds as backwards. And in fact, when one of the Free Southern Theater actors landed in Mississippi, Denise Nicholas, she said, "I felt I had landed on another planet. I felt alone and scared." Nina Simone, everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn, Tennessee's bad, Alabama's bad, but Mississippi. So in many ways, in many ways, it's the bastion of inequality. So the fact that they're able to do this work in Mississippi means a lot. The Free Southern Theater was established at Tougaloo College in part because, you know, there was a conversation about establishing it at Jackson State, which is a public historically black college. But they knew that the state, because of how radical this theater was, the state would pull funding from Jackson State. Because Tougaloo was private, it was established there in part. So there are these stories when I was doing research of activists sort of running from the police in Mississippi and sort of hurling, tossing their bodies over the gate to Tougaloo College, because once they got behind the gate, in some ways they were safe from the police. What's so interesting about the theater being started at Tougaloo, I graduated from Tougaloo College as an undergrad. I never heard of that theater the entire time I was there. So a part of what I was trying to sort of think about then was, why is it that these histories of theater and the civil rights movement are so suppressed? How can I move through this campus for 4 years? My wife also graduated from Tougaloo. Neither of us ever heard about that theater one time.
Wow. So you talk about Moses O'Neill in Derby, and I think if I'm looking in the chat, Adam was asking a question and Judy responds. I think she responds. Am I making that up? I don't know. The chat is so long now, but I want to know if Judy, do you want to jump in and share a story? Because there's parts in the book where those relationships get woven together. Do we have Judy? Does she want
Yeah,
to?
I'm here. I'm
Oh,
here.
yay, there you
Okay.
go.
No, first of all, thank you so much for this book. I cannot wait to read it. And honey, anybody who writes from Mississippi about the theater and about black patients is my person. So thank you. But no, in terms of the theater, as far as I know, John O'Neill and Denise and Doris Derby, I don't think it came out of the role playing, as Adam Sanchez had just asked, the wonderful Adam Sanchez. So I think, but what was amazing to me is that they would be doing these plays, of course, like Godot and all, I mean, plays that I had difficulty understanding. These folks coming out of the sharecroppers, coming out of the fields, no problem. They saw the relationship with having to wait. They saw the relationship with who was the master and who was supposed to be the servant. I mean, all of that, they got the relationships and they automatically translated it to their own lives. And that's what was amazing to me, in a way that I could not.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, and
Absolutely.
I want to stay there. That's such a powerful point, right? I remember being in high school and reading Waiting for Godot and being like, so Godot don't come? Like, well, what's up with that? And I think there's something really brilliant about black people staging this particular play. And you talk about how, whether it's cotton fields or front porches, and it really challenges this idea of who's doing the intellectual organizing, right? And when I think about being a high school teacher, there were ways that I was asked to kind of track and cluster students, like who are going to be our high performing students. But it's something about reading what black folks are doing with plays like that, or even Ozzie, let me go back to what I jotted down, or even Ozzie Davis's Purple Victorious, I wrote it down incorrectly, or in White America. And I would just love to hear some stories about what it was like for not just the folks staging and performing in these plays, but what it was like for folks to experience these plays. And what was the response? Because you were starting to talk a little bit about that. But black people in theater are doing some heavy critical thinking, not just the performers, but again, the people in the audience. And I think this is important for us to think about as classroom teachers. When we think about even what a text is, anyway, I'll stop.
Yeah, no, earlier you mentioned we were talking about just how education is coming under attack, how knowledge is coming under attack. and how art is coming under attack. There's a reason why books by Toni Morrison and others are being banned, because folk in power recognize the transformation of consciousness, the new ways of seeing the world that are opened up through art. And this is exactly what happened when the Free Southern Theater was working in the Mississippi Delta. As Judy was saying, most of these people actually were sharecroppers. Many of them didn't even have an eighth grade education. And I was doing research. There were the theater recorded notes, and they would write things like, "Negro lady in audience says, this play makes me think about," there's a master slave duo in the play. And at one point, the slave takes the rope off of his neck, and the Negro lady says, "Oh, this makes me want to take the rope off my neck." Fannie Lou Hamer was at the performances in Ruleville, Mississippi, and she stands up at intermission, and also once the play is ended, and she says that we are like these men waiting for Godot, and the reason the Negro is as far behind as he is because we've been waiting. So what's so interesting is that white journalists will come down from New York because they were so fascinated by the possibility, right? They assumed that black people in Mississippi couldn't understand these plays. What they didn't talk about was that when the play opened in Miami, a lot of white people didn't even get it, right? And so when they came, like Judy, they were astonished that these black people got that play.
Yeah, right on, right on. Judy, do you want to share one more story before I'm gonna cut out of the waiting for Godot?
No, just that it's always about and because then it relates to the Black Arts Movement. Always there's a way that we use all the forms, that are at our disposal to get our lives out there, because we have been so misinterpreted and all that stuff that we know. So the main thing is that we are now through all of these things, the Free Southern Theater and the photography and it's all the way that we have our voice again, and it's anyway, I'm going to shut up because I really want to
No,
hear him.
I love this polyphonic conversation because I think it's important that your lived experience is in conversation with the lived experiences that
That's
Julius was able to excavate.
right.
And Julius, do you want to say anything else about Waiting for Godot before? Because I want to talk a little bit about Kix and Co.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say about Waiting for Godot, sometimes, we want perfect radical histories. There were moments where, for example, SNCC activists said about the Free Southern Theater, "We don't have time for this. We're staging voter registration drives. They're running around with their props in their wagon, getting in the way of the movement, basically." Also, there were little kids at the performance who threw spitballs at the stage. There were some people who walked out because the play bored them. So the last thing I'll say is that I don't want to suggest that all of a sudden all black people in Mississippi were digging what the Free Southern Theater was putting down. We're human. And so some people weren't biting what they were trying to feed. That's important to note.
Yeah, thank you.
And
Thank you for
the
that.
last thing I'll say, Judy, there was one story in the when I was doing research, there was an old man who lived in a shack not too far from Fannie Lou Hamer. While they were staging Waiting for Godot, he turned his lawnmower on the entire play to drown out the sound of the play, to let the white people know that he wasn't on board with it.
Boy.
Yeah.
And so what's amazing is that it still survived, that people still came in the same way that they still came down to vote even after people were beaten. They still kept coming. They never stopped. That's the beauty of your book.
Wow, thank you, thank you. And so the cool thing is black theater workers were not only staging and interpreting plays written by other folks, there were black folks who were writing what you describe as a civil rights themed musical. So I was like, oh shucks, that's a new genre for me. So talk a little bit about Kick and Co. Like who wrote it, how was it received, and why is this story also important to teach about the civil rights movement?
Yeah, that's a good question. So black people love music, and in the civil rights movement, music was just so important at the meetings, the march, those sorts of things. And so a lot of black artists felt that they wanted to tap into that energy and write musicals because it was such a part of that political moment and a part of black culture. And also music was a way for black communities to come together. So Langston Hughes wrote a play called Jericho Jim Crow that is a musical. And there were some white audience members who were like, "I don't understand why these people are singing in the middle of the play." And Hughes says, "This is the point. right? We want them to interrupt or disrupt the performance. We want the call and response, invite them to participate, right? So we see how, you know, kind of this Black aesthetic, even before the Black Arts Movement, this Black aesthetic is already at work. Oscar Brown Jr., the play you mentioned, there's a very similar thing. Of course, he's known for his music. He also has this kind of identity in Chicago as an announcer. But this was supposed to be the big Black play. Right after Lorraine Hansberry, this was supposed to be it. It raised tons of cash. He was on a Garraway show, right? And they called it, the white critics called it, quote, a surefire contender for Broadway. Sammy Davis Jr. saw the play. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. saw the play. And he wrote a letter to Sammy Davis Jr. talking about how good it was and sort of how it showed what art can do for the civil rights movement. But when those white audiences got to the theater and they saw how radical that play was, it didn't make it out of Chicago.
This
Right?
is powerful. So the way I interpret this is, you know, Jess, you put that syllabus together. It could get all the great feedback from my folks at Teaching for Change, my folks at the Zen Education Project, from the SNCC Legacy Project. But if I come in there really serving that fire, you know, my employers might say, wait, Jess, you took it too far. When at first you were just coming in here smelling like cocoa butter and talking about whatever, it was fine. But now you're going a little deeper. So it's okay that if we don't have a long run, so to speak, because that might not mean that we're not doing the work that we need to do, but it might mean that we are working on the work so that we can keep this movement going. That's what that play really, really taught me. And it challenges how I think about the long civil rights movement. Even if something doesn't last for a long time, it doesn't mean that the impact isn't lasting. I guess that's what I would say.
That's right. That's right. And I think a part of, if I'm being honest, a part of what frustrated me is that I was encountering a lot of historians who would assume that this work wasn't going on. And they were saying things like the 1950s and 60s weren't radical. And I'm like, people were fired from their jobs for voting. People were murdered. They had bombs thrown at them. What's not radical about it? And so a part of what they argue, and this is the long civil rights movement argument, is that if we really want radicalism, we have to go back to like 1930s and 1940s, communism. And what that move does is to say that the people who are really radical are white communists. That's a problem, because I want to think about those Black people in the 50s and 60s who sacrificed everything for that movement. And we can't write them out of history. The last thing I'll say about Hicks & Co. is that it's important for us to note, to your point about, you know, maybe they accept the teaching or the syllabus or the text selection at first, but then it's a little too radical. Lorraine Hansberry worked with that play. And we have to keep in mind that just years before 1959, her play was everything. America loved that play because they misread it. And the critics, even the FBI surveilled that play. They were in the audience. And the FBI agent basically said, hey, guys, we don't have anything to worry about. It's just a play about what he called Negro aspirations. He missed all the deep, other deep radical messages anyway. So that when Lorraine Hansberry decided to work with Kicks & Co., the white community was relieved. But what they got was something radically different.
So we singing Wade in the Water, you know, and it's perceived that we just happy singing, but really we laying down the tracks, that we're coding the message for how to steal away home, for example. So I really appreciate that there's more than one way to read radicalism, and there's more than one way to teach the Black freedom struggle. And so I hope that folks who are educators, teacher educators, are also thinking about the social studies element, the ELA element, but also the arts element, right? Because whether I'm a classroom teacher who teaches science and chemistry, but has a love for theater and art, I'm also thinking about how outside of my classroom, I'm using extracurricular spaces to also continue to teach the Black freedom struggle. And so that's what I really love about Black patience and what you're teaching me about performance. Now, not to get too theoretical, but we're about to take a break in just a moment to talk through what we've heard and how we might apply this. But tell me a little bit about why theater and the Black body, let me think about that question some more, because I think you just did such a great job at looking at the ways in which repetition is a way to either keep power the way to keep things the way they are, or whether repetition can be used to unsettle and challenge power structures and domination in a way that I think is very important as I think about teaching the Black freedom movement.
Yeah, so I think that's a great question to end on before the break, because repetition is important. The minute slavery is abolished in this country, right? You talked about the afterlives of slavery. Those people got to work figuring out ways to keep Black people oppressed, right? The chain gang, in prison, they came up with laws like loitering laws, basically that said that if Black people were caught standing around, they could be arrested, and once they were arrested, they were put on a chain gang. Well, what were they put on a chain gang to do? To work for white people, white capitalists, to make money in the ways that they did during slavery. So in that way, white supremacy repeats itself, right? So we shouldn't be surprised that after the civil rights movement, we get the rolling back of those gains, or after affirmative action, we get the rolling back of those gains, or after Barack Obama, we get everything that we have now. It repeats itself. But also, the thing I love about Black art is that it also repeats itself. So if we think about a play like Waiting for Godot, yes, there were the Mississippi Delta audiences, right, that was used for during the civil rights movement, but also when Hurricane Katrina hit, and those Black people in 2005 were left to wait on their house roofs, right, for the federal government. What play did those Black activists turn to talk about waiting? It was Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot, right? In Haifa, in Japan, all around the world, this play is being used in radical ways. So there's also like the repetition of radical art that I think is important.
We keep coming back. This is beautiful. And I will be remiss, and I was reminded that our namesake Zen wrote three plays. Howard Zinn also wrote plays because he believed in the transformative power of art and art for political and social activism and transformation. And then the last thing I want to do is I want to just kind of underscore some points and recap. So Black theater was a space in which Black people rehearsed and staged Black freedom and liberation. Black theater and Black theater workers were critical to the success of the civil rights movement and helped engage a base of people who might not have otherwise gotten involved in the Black freedom movement through activism and organizing. And then I want to kind of clarify what we are talking about in the context of Black patients from the first half, because we are going to talk a little bit about another way that Black patience can be thought of. But Black patience from the first half of today was really naming the ways that time is weaponized against Black people and the ways in which virtues like patience are weaponized against Black people, forcing us to repeatedly perform waiting as a criterion for their freedom. And so through thinking about Black patience, it shows how theater was used to perform a different style of freedom and liberation work through intellect for sure, but also art and creativity in ways that go hand in hand with the sit-in movements, the freedom rides, the jail-ins. All right. So with that said, I want to go to the 1960s back. Well, we've been in the 1960s, and one of the things, Julius, that I really appreciate your book for is it helped me understand that the movement is a lot deeper and a lot wider than I thought. And it really challenged me to think more about who was participating and how they were participating in the Black freedom struggle. So with this kind of deeper and wider understanding of the Black freedom movement or the Black freedom struggle, how might educators, students, educator allies on the call today take up this history and implement its lessons today? So, in other words, how can the lessons from Black patience help us imagine how we can use art and culture to engage socially and politically during this particular climate?
That's a good question, and I'll say, I think I'll start just by thinking about theater as an art form. In the 1940s, the 1950s, we have these great novels by Black novelists like Ralph Ellison, Richard Wright, right? In this, in the 1950s and 60s, we do have Black novels, but not that they don't rise to that kind of like iconic level. There's a reason why, because there's a lot of investment in theater because the civil rights movement is a boiling moment. It's a boiling point, right? And Black people turn to theater because it's an art form that allows them to be together in community. And so in theater studies, there's this term, right, this Latin term that we use called communitas. And it basically thinks about the ways in which theater invites people to come together in community. So in Mississippi, it was coming together in a cotton field, for example, or around the back porch of a shack. And so I think, as we think about this moment, we're going to need a lot of not people reading individual novels. We need that too. We need a lot of art forms that allow us to come together, to use art to think through a problem in the ways that they did during the civil rights movement. And also theater as a strategy of teaching. I've done some high school classroom visits when I visited colleges, and students, I would give them like a little assignment to work together to do a little theatrical exercise. They love the coming together as a way of learning. So using theater as a tool to teach, I think, is also important.
Yeah, thank you. Right now, teachers, scores of teachers and librarians, especially but not exclusively, are being forced out of their classrooms, forced out of libraries, and are being fired some because of their commitment to teaching a people's history of the United States. And in many ways, they're being surveilled and confined for standing in service of Black freedom and democracy for all. And this really reminds me a lot of freedom fighters like. My bad, like Ruby Doris Smith that you talk about, Diane Nash, who joined the sit-in movement. They participated in the Freedom Rides. They got arrested. Then they refused bail. So in essence, those two, Doris Smith and Nash and other civil rights activists used the jailing strategy to push back against the violence of white resistance to Black freedom, but also the violence of being incarcerated for demanding freedom now. So how did civil rights activists who used like a jailing strategy respond to being incarcerated? That's my first thing. And then how did those two activists in particular subvert kind of Black patience in the way we've been thinking about it in the beginning, in terms of like the violent ways that time and space have been used against Black people? So how did they use that jailing strategy and how did they respond to being incarcerated? And how did they subvert Black patients through their incarceration?
Yeah, that's a good question. So during the civil rights movement, Black people were really careful not to appear too radical, not to appear too quote unquote Black, because there were all of these stereotypes circulating about Black people in ways that still circulate today. They were violent, they had quick tempers, and so they were, someone mentioned role playing earlier. So SNCC and other organizations, again, they rehearse how to remain patient in the moment of protest, how someone can pull your hair and you remain patient, right? And so a part of what they wanted to do was to sort of respond to sheriffs like Bull Connor. This is really sort of the early moments of mass incarceration. They said, because these Black people are so interested in sort of being moral, we're going to throw them in jail because Black communities don't like imprisoned folk. They were going to start to take some of their moral authority. But what Black people did during the movement was to actually transform the very meaning of the jail so that it's not this container, this badge of shame. It was an honor to go to jail for the civil rights movement. So you mentioned Diane Nash. She had a trial, and the judge decided not to send her to jail. She was upset. She's like, I want to go to jail, right? Because she wanted to use waiting as a way to push back against Black patients. So to your second part of your question, where I end the book is like, I think about the sit-ins and the jailings, and I ask, like, how do Black people turn Black patients on its head? How do they wait in that jail, perform a kind of Black patience to disrupt Black patients? And it makes me think about my grandmother, actually. When I was growing up, she used to tell us, I'm an oldest grandchild of 21. And because I had to protect my cousins, sometimes I could have a bit of a temper if you mess with my family. And sometimes I would tell people what I would do to them if they mess with my family. And my grandmother said to me, she said, you have to talk less. And if you're gonna flip the world, don't let them know until they're flipping. And that stuck with me. It was about waiting. It was about lying in wait before you stage the attack. And so that opened up ways for me of thinking about how waiting can also be radical.
Oh no, that's powerful. And for folks who know me, I bring my ancestors, my grandmother, my great grandmother here with me. And what you just shared was so powerful, like that's political wisdom, what your granny taught you. And it's making me think a lot about our benevolent ancestors and how this work of challenging Black patients, subverting Black patients, let them know, let's us let them know that their organized efforts for freedom were not in vain, but instead their freedom desires and their freedom fights live in our veins. And it can be performed in so many different ways. And I think that's what I was also trying to get at earlier with the Black body. The Black body is also a resource that we can use in our movement for freedom just by how we do or don't wait, or whether we move like literally through protesting or whether we move through the gestures that we embody on stages as well.
And I think, you know, this makes me think of sometimes, you know, you mentioned teachers who are being fired and for teaching certain things. I think it is important, especially as we think about activism and education, that we strategize. So there are people who perhaps might have to play or might be comfortable playing the role of kind of our agitator. But we also need people, and I'll just be frank, I was criticized by graduate students even because I began my job at the University of Maryland when Freddie Gray happened in Baltimore. And they were asking me, "Are you going to go and march in the streets?" And I'm a realist. I'm a black, a heavyset black man with locks and earrings. They don't see my Penn PhD. They don't see an Ivy League PhD. They see a black man with locks. Same thing when I was in graduate school with the Occupy movement. There were certain ways that I had to participate because of how I'm embodied. I was the only black man when I started my job, and a only black tenure track male professor in a department of 76 professors. Right. And so there were things that would happen, and I would say to myself, well, I can be loud and I could protest in this way, or I can be strategically quiet and I can move pieces without them ever knowing that the pieces are being moved. Right. And I've seen the materialization of the gains, right? At the same time, I had colleagues who moved another way. So a part of what I'm saying is that we also need to be careful not to see the people who appear to be quiet as somehow not radical or somehow not engaged in activism. We're going to need all of our collective activisms.
Yeah, right on. And I really appreciate that because what activism looks like for me, Jessica, here in Washington, D.C., might look different for a Jessica in Washington State. And that's very, very real. So I'm just scanning the chat right now to see if we have any questions. But as we look to the chat, specifically around this notion of being strategically quiet, I want to go back to the Black people who were not so quiet. You write about how in 1956, I believe it is, William Faulkner, who's often taught in the secondary US classroom, he writes this letter to Life magazine. I'm gonna try to pull it up. Basically, and at the time, I mean, yes. So he's a Nobel Prize winning author. He's encouraging Black Southerners to wait or to defer their freedom rights. And you use this language of his comments being steeped in a grammar of time and space. And so you talk about time, like this idea of being immediate in space and this idea of integration. So I'm curious about how some Black folks in the civil rights movement responded to William Faulkner and what their response says about the new racial order that the civil rights movement was beginning to establish.
So William Faulkner was that guy. You know, he was the popular white modernist writer, especially throughout the U.S. South. They still revere him, right? They have conferences around him. And what's so special about Faulkner is that he actually saw himself as a sort of liberal white person, in many ways, if not a friend of the Negro, somebody who at least has a certain intimacy with the Negro, who knows the Negro. So his article in Life magazine, and keep in mind, he writes his article as a response to Brown v. Board of Education, which allegedly led to desegregation of public schools. And in that Supreme Court decision, the court said that you should integrate these schools. And the important phrase was with all deliberate speed. And those white Southerners, that set them off. And they set about trying to do it, not at all, over all deliberate slowness. And so Faulkner goes to Life magazine to appeal directly to black people in the South, whom he thinks that he knows, you know, like he's their boy. And he's like, okay, I understand you kind of want freedom, but don't move too fast. Wait. He says to them literally, quote, wait, wait now, right? wait, wait now. And so that's his effort to slow down what he saw Brown unleashing.
And then in response, we have folks like, I gotta go back to the book. I had to get my specific names, but I think you mentioned earlier like Langston Hughes. So how did folks respond?
So Ralph Ellison, in a
It was
private,
Ellison, yeah.
Ralph Ellison basically called him a fool, you know, he's fool, a fool. In his letter to Albert Murray, James Baldwin writes a scathing article about William Faulkner. There's a black woman playwright, whose name is Lola Joan Amis, and she writes a play, called "The New Nigger," Who's Afraid of William Faulkner? So they see the game that Faulkner is up to, that is black people and black artists, and they push back against it.
So this is beautiful, right? So one, there's so many different ways to strategically participate in the Black Freedom Movement. Two, black artists were absolutely critical to this particular during this particular era of the 50s and 60s, and even today, and especially today. So one of the things when I was a high school teacher, I had a art teacher colleague who was, yeah, she believed in art for transformation and art to help raise awareness to help create access points. So what I really love about Black patience is that we can use performance, we can use theater to help finish the project of emancipation. So before we wrap up, are there any like closing thoughts or stories you want to leave us with?
I think it's important for us to, white supremacy and anti-blackness are so ingrained in society. It doesn't need white, they don't need white people to function. So, when we think about black patience, it's easy to think about this as a violent project that only white people engage in toward black people. But I want to think about what it meant for President Obama after black people are murdered in a church in Charleston to ask black people to be patient and to forgive, right? And a part of that comes from, we don't want to portray ourselves. And this happens every time black people are murdered, where they get to the mothers of the victims and they give them this prepared script to say, I pray for, I don't want any violence. I forgive the aggressor. And I get it, but we have to think about where that comes from. There's a wonderful clip from Toni Morrison where she talks about Rodney King and she talks about the LA riots. And she says, everybody is saying, she's in an interview, everybody's saying, oh my God, those riots were so bad. And Toni Morrison says, oh, I was saying, oh my God, I'm surprised they waited for so long. She said they waited for justice for a year. And it was only when they delivered those not guilty verdicts that they set that city on fire. So a part of what I'll leave us with is that black patience is not just a thing from white people. Minority people can participate in it as well. And the other thing is that it's not just a project from the civil rights movement. My parents live in Jackson, Mississippi. They still don't have clean water. They are still waiting for clean water. We know about Flint, right? At the University of Chicago, right, the trauma center that was closed, black people then had to wait for a long ambulance ride to Northwestern University. So in other words, black patience is still with us, and we still have to be innovative about how we combat it.
Thank you. I'm demanding freedom now, right now. So Dr. Fleming, Julius Fleming, Dr. J, I now we want to just say thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. This podcast is brought to you by the Zen Education Project, coordinated by Teaching for Change and Rethinking Schools.
Music provided by The Blue Tide, a Seattle-based acoustic blues duo of Daniel Rapport and J.D. Lenore, a.k.a. Jesse Hagopian. You can find them on Spotify, Apple Music, or wherever you get your music.